Goddag og velkommen til Langsomme Samtaler. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Jeg har i den her uge talt med den amerikanske samfundsforsker og forfatter Francis Fukuyama, som efterhånden er blevet 71 år gammel. Han er i dag professor i politisk videnskab ved Stanford University i Californien. Fukuyama har en interessant historie, fordi han som ung var filosofistuderende og blandt andet kom til Frankrig og studerede poststrukturalisme, og meget tidligt blev fortrolig med de tanker, som skulle blive dominerende i 90'ernes akademiske miljø i USA. Det vil sige, at han forstod Michel Foucault, han forstod Jacques Derrida temmelig tidligt. Han er vokset op intellektuelt med Kochefs berømte Hegel-forelæsning, og så han har ligesom det intellektuelle fundament, som blev udgangspunktet for rigtig mange venstreorienterede op gennem 90'erne og 00'erne. Men Francis Fukuyama valgte en karriere som embedsmand og arbejdede i det amerikanske udenrigsministerium, da han i 1989 udgav et essay, som skulle blive et af de mest berømte essays overhovedet i det 20. århundrede, nemlig The End of History. The End of History udkom som en bog i 1992, og den er faktisk oversat til dansk og udgivet på Informationsforlag. Tesen i The End of History var ikke, at historien var slut i den forstand, at der ikke ville ske mere i verden, men at alle konflikter var gået væk. Tesen var, at der var to idéer, der stod tilbage som de sejrende idéer, og det var idéhistoriens politiske afslutning. At der var to idéer, der stod tilbage, som mødtes i en styreform. Den ene idé er individets ukrænkelighed, som er kodificeret i menneskerettighederne. Det er den liberale idé. Det er i forlængelse af Kant, at et hvert menneskeliv er ukrænkeligt, og et hvert menneskeliv skal være beskyttet af rettigheder og kan aldrig nogensinde bare blive et middel til at opnå noget andet. Det er den liberale side af ligningen. Den anden side af det er den demokratiske side af ligningen, og den er, at den eneste legitime kilde til politisk magt kommer nedefra, den kommer fra folket. Og derfor kunne Francis Fukuyama i starten af 90'erne skrev sin bog, hvor han konkluderede, at det liberale demokrati havde vundet den idehistoriske kamp. For mange har det ligesom været et latterligt udsagn, fordi der er så meget, der har bevæget sig væk fra det liberale demokrati siden, og fordi kineserne ikke udviklede liberalt demokrati, og inderne udviklede deres egen form for kapitalisme og autoritær liberalisme, og fordi der opstod nogle modsætninger i de vestlige samfund, som udfordrede det liberale demokratis præmisser. Hvis man skal læse med Fukuyama, og det synes jeg, man bør, så er hans pointe dengang, at det liberale og det demokratiske var de to principper, som man skulle begrunde en demokratisk orden på. Hans pointe var ikke, at de ikke kunne komme i konflikt med hinanden. Og hvis man ser på mange af de konflikter, vi har haft omkring forfatningsdomstole, vi har haft omkring immigrationspolitik, som vi har haft omkring vores forhold til konventioner, som vi har haft i forhold til parlamenternes magt, som vi har haft i forhold til alle mulige samspil mellem det flertallet vil have og de internationale konventioner, som vi har ladet os begrænse af, så er det netop historiens afslutningsidékamp, som vi har set udfolde sig i vores egne vestlige demokratier. Men den bedste bog, Fukuyama har skrevet, er efter min helt klare opfattelse hans tobindsværk om politisk orden. Det første bind, der hedder Political Order, udkom i 2011, og det andet bind, som hedder Political Order and Political Decay, kom i 2014. Og her stiller han spørgsmålet, hvordan det kan være, at liberale demokratier kan gå i opløsning. Hvad er det for nogle indre modsigelser, og hvad er det for nogle blinde vinkler, der var i hans oprindelige teori? Og hvorfor er der, spørger han, ingen teori om, hvordan demokratiet forfalder, men alle mulige teorier om, hvordan man når hen til demokratiet? Som sagt, så synes jeg, det fantastiske ved Fukuyama, det er, at han bevæger sin analyse med verdenshistorien. Han var kendt som neokonservativ i slutningen af 80'erne og starten af 90'erne, og hvis man læser The End of History i dag, er det tydeligt, at der også er nogle meget Nietzsche-inspirerede, svulstige forestillinger om mennesket og slapheden i fællesskabet. Til gengæld så siger han på et tidspunkt i det 21. århundrede, at det er gået op for ham, at de store katastrofer, der er sket i hans liv, de er produktet af konservative idéer. Den ene, det er Irakkrigen, som fik kolossalt destruktiv indflydelse på USA's internationale anseelse og vestens politiske autoritet. Og det andet, det var finanskrisen, som ligesom var et produkt af et par årtiers markedsfundamentalisme. Og Fukuyama brugte selv udtrykket markedsfundamentalisme. Så derfor flyttede han sin egen analyse. I sin seneste bog, som hedder Liberalism and its Discontents, der spørger han, hvordan kan det være, at vi i Vesten har mistet troen på den politiske liberalisme, som var så dominerende i den periode i det 20. århundrede, hvor vi opnåede enestående fremskridt i social retfærdighed, velstand og udvikling på samme tid. Hvordan kan det være, at det der for 50 år siden var den sejrende politiske ideologi, nu er trængt overalt? Da jeg var ung i 90'erne, der var den politiske liberalisme nærmest horisonten omkring vores politiske modsætninger, og i dag der er den blevet én pol i de politiske modsætninger. Jeg taler også med i samtalen, der følger, med Francis Fukuyama om, hvordan han ser krigen i Ukraine. Vi har sat nogle præmisser op, som gør, at de skal slås for deres frihed, uden at vi sætter soldater ind, og uden at vi giver dem våben, som gør, at de kan ramme ind i Rusland. Nu er vi på et tidspunkt, hvor Rusland har militær overhånd, og vi fastholder vores egen præmisser for ukrainernes krig. Spørgsmålet er selvfølgelig, kan vi besejre Rusland derfra, eller kommer Ukraine til at blive ofret, fordi vi har sat de præmisser op for os selv? Vi taler om krigen i Israel og Gaza. Spørgsmålet er, hvad det gør for den internationale orden, at det nu er Vestens allierede, der går imod en resolution i Sikkerhedsrådet og en ordre fra den internationale domstol. Og spørgsmålet er, hvordan de to krige i Gaza og Ukraine, de stiller os, hvis man holder dem op imod hinanden. Vi taler også i samtalen her om de sammenstød, der har været på de amerikanske universiteter, om demonstranterne over for pengemagten, fordi Fukuyama har været ekstremt optaget af det, som man kalder for cancel culture, nemlig ønsket om at forbyde holdninger, man ikke bryder sig om at tale, som man finder krænkende og skadelige, og hvor det stiller de aktuelle Palæstina-demonstrationer hen. Her følger altså min samtale med vores gamle intellektuelle vejleder og rejsekammerat gennem de seneste årtiers ekstreme globale turbulens, Francis Fukuyama.
We've been following the world through your work for 20 years, 25 years. You've been very, very helpful, both with the optimism in the 90s and your books about political order were extremely helpful to understand the transition that we're in. And right now here in Denmark, and I think in Europe generally, people are asking themselves how serious a threat to our societies and our liberal order would a new Trump presidency be? And yeah, I spoke to Darren Acemoglu a couple of months ago. He said he wasn't as alarmed this time as he was the last time, because he said he was surprised and impressed by the resistance of the institutions. And he said democracies are very, very hard to erase as long as people believe in them. Then I spoke to Daniel Seeblatt from Harvard, and he was very alarmed by the prospect of another Trump presidency. How serious do you think we should take the prospect of another Trump presidency, and what are the stakes in your view?
I think that I'm much closer to Seeblatt's position than to Acemoglu's. I think that you cannot rely on the experience of the first Trump term to predict what's going to happen in the second, because things are actually quite different. In the first Trump presidency, he didn't come into office with a lot of associates or people that were aligned with his views. He had to rely on the old Republican establishment. And so he went through 44 cabinet secretaries in his 4 years, because ultimately these, I think, centrist Republicans did not jive with, you know, his populist agenda. And so they kept either resigning or he'd fire them. And I think the people he ended up with at the end of his term, you know, in the last couple of months before the election, are more indicative of what you're going to get in a second Trump term. Their main criteria for selection will be personal loyalty to Trump. And in fact, the Republican National Committee it's now taken over by Trump's family. And apparently the first question they ask if you apply to work for them is, do you believe the 2020 election was stolen? And if you say no, then you're not going to get a job, you know, in the new administration. There's this, you probably heard this Heritage Foundation Project 2025, which is planning a number of things. So one is it's laying the legal groundwork for a purge, a massive purge of the civil service, the American civil service. And they are, you know, making lists of people that they would like to replace in the civil service, you know, all of the people, you know, for example, during the COVID pandemic that, you know, gave Trump advice he didn't like, you know, they would be replaced by loyalists. And I think that it means that a second Trump term is going to be right from the beginning much more effective because he will have a lot of people that, you know, will be supporting him. The other thing is you just have to listen to what he's been saying at these rallies. You know, he still intends to pull out of NATO. Revenge is, I think, his number one priority. So he wants to go after all of the people and institutions that he perceives are his personal enemies. And so that means many people in the media. That means the FBI, big parts of the Justice Department. He wants to prosecute what he calls the Biden crime family. So all of these things, I think, are going to consume him immediately in the early stages of a second administration. And it's going to really test the system because I don't think it's true that it survived the first 4 years. But the second 4 years, I think, are going to be much more difficult.
You know, I actually been to a couple of his rallies in South Carolina here in February, and I find it hard to really figure out how much of it is a political project and how much it is just sheer vanity. So of course, it sounds scary and it sounds destructive when he talks about NATO, but also when he talks about the green transition and the investment, some of the investments that America is undertaking. But do you see his administration capable of actually transforming the political institutions in the U.S.?
Well, I think that they're much more capable than they were in his first term, because, you know, what an administration is people. And he's going to bring in many more true believers. Now, of course, a lot of them are going to be incompetent. They won't understand how government really works, and they'll be stymied by all of the, you know, rules and precedents and laws that exist in the American system. But that's why I think his tendency towards authoritarianism is actually something we ought to take very seriously, because, you know, in his first term, if the court and particularly the Supreme Court said that he can't do something, he would back down. But he's given a lot of indications that if he really wants to do something next time around and the court says you can't do it, he's just going to ignore them, which would obviously set off a huge constitutional crisis. So I just think that you cannot assume, you know, you cannot project what his behavior is going to be from what it was in the past, because he's just deteriorated in many ways personally. You know, he can only talk about himself. He can only talk about all of these indignities that he claims that he suffered. And I really do think that that's, you know, and he's going to get a lot of support. I think the most disturbing thing about the American political system right now is that a huge number of Republicans believe him. You know, more than half of them believe that vaccines are more dangerous than helpful. You know, something like 60-70% of them agree that the 2020 election was stolen and that Biden is an illegitimate president. And so all of these crazy conspiracy theories and fantasies are not just Trump, and they won't go away if Trump is defeated. It's going to be, I think, it's sort of like a poison that's been injected into the bloodstream of the American political system, and it's going to take a while for that poison to be flushed out.
I think one thing that is really remarkable coming from Europe, because of course we see some of the same tendencies here, but we don't see them to the extreme as you do in America. And one thing that is really striking is that when you cover American elections, and I've covered the last 8 elections, also the midterms and the primaries, is that you meet people who are generous people, hospitable people, and who deeply regret the polarization and divisions in America. Of course, they blame it on Democrats, but who actually do support the worldview of Donald Trump. They believe it. They believe it to be true. And this, the incapacity of American society to establish a common reality of recognized fact, we don't have that to the same extent in Europe
at all. No, definitely not.
And I find it extremely scary. And I know this is a big question, but how do you explain this corrosion of a common accepted reality?
Well, I think that a lot of people since 2016 have been looking at social media and the internet. And I actually think that this is a much more important factor than people think, because it's really enabled what you might call bespoke realities, you know, that you don't like the way the world is portrayed by the mainstream media, but you've got this complete worldview that's been created for you online, and it will reaffirm every crazy conspiracy theory and, you know, alternative interpretation of events. And so I think a lot of Americans are simply living in these alternative realities. So, for example, there's this debate about whether support for democracy has been declining, especially among young people. And there's some poll data that indicates that. I really disbelieve that. I think the problem is that people just start with different factual assumptions. And so people supporting Donald Trump believe they're supporting the U.S. Constitution, and that they're battling, you know, the most massive electoral fraud in American history, and it's the Democrats that are not respecting the Constitution. And so they don't actually disbelieve in the virtues of the Constitution and electoral democracy. They just don't believe the facts about the last election. And I think that that's, you know, a lot of it. So much of life has now moved online and has lived online, where it's possible, you know, it's just like superhero movies, you know, or when you play a video game, you get to step into an alternate persona, and you have all of this kind of virtual reality around you to support that persona. And I think that that's what's happened to a lot of Americans. That's the only way I can explain the prevalence of conspiracy theories. And I think that really, in a way, what the definition of a populist, in my view, has kind of evolved into someone that actually believes, you know, a lot of conspiracy theories, that reality, you know, you've taken the red pill and you realize that reality is not, you know, what the mainstream media and those around you are saying. It's really this hidden reality, but you've been privileged to have access to, you know, that the truth about reality, and you realize it's completely different. So I think that that's, you know, what's driving a lot of people. Now, social media exists in Europe as well. So in a way, I haven't really, you know, answered your question. You know, and I think there are a number of reasons why it's more powerful in the United States. You know, the U.S. just has a deeper anti-state tradition. This is something that many people have written about as an aspect of American exceptionalism. Americans, both on the right and on the left, do not trust the government. And so they are, you know, very happy to believe in conspiracy theories about how there's an elite cabal hidden within the deep state that's really trying to take away their rights. And, you know, the kind of positive feelings that, you know, people in Denmark would have about the nature of their welfare state and the community consensus that supports that simply does not exist in the United States, where, you know, the modal response to anything that happens involving the government is distrust and a belief that the real story must be much more sinister than, you know, what's being portrayed.
Another striking aspect of America, and I think that goes in Europe as well, that you address in your book, Liberalism and Its Discontents, is the lack of confidence in liberal principles. And when I was young in the 90s, liberalism was not a position. It was the horizon of positions.
Yes.
That you would have social democrats, you'd have third way democrats, and you'd have neoliberals. they were all within the spectrum of liberalism.
Yeah, that's true.
And I thought that was the political battleground of my life. How surprised are you that we're now 30 years later and that these basic principles are not only contested by fringes, but actually at the center of our politics?
Well, I'm very surprised that that's happened. I think that, you know, part of the story is generations succeeding one another that have very different worldviews shaped by their experiences. And so the generation that lived through certainly World War II, but the Cold War, kind of understood the alternative to liberalism really didn't look very good. That was the Soviet Union, maybe Maoist China, you know, so forth. But I think that now we're living in a prolonged period really of liberal peace and prosperity. You know, the European Union has enriched Europeans. It's made Europe peaceful. Something similar has happened in the United States and other developed countries. And I think that, you know, a lot of the skepticism about liberalism exists among, you know, Gen Z or Gen X people who were born after the Cold War. And so they don't really see what the alternative to liberalism is. And they can imagine that there's a, you know, a socialist alternative that's actually going to bring about social justice and equality and that sort of thing. So I think that's part of it. It's actually the success of liberalism that has made people take it for granted and not understand that the alternatives are terrible. And you've now had some, you know, right-wing intellectuals that have, you know, so it used to be that, especially among conservatives, everybody accepted that liberal framework. Ronald Reagan was a classic liberal, you know, believed in individual freedom and private property and so forth. But I think you're now getting conservative theorists like Patrick Deneen or Adrian Vermeule or so forth that do not accept the liberal framework. And they're now trying to construct, you know, more serious kinds of arguments. I think those efforts are ridiculous. I think they're completely unpersuasive. And in that respect, you know, the Ukraine war may have served a useful function. It's terrible for the Ukrainians, but I think it does offer a point of contrast to what a non-liberal, you know, society looks like. Now, what I find just staggeringly unbelievable is the fact that so many people on the American right have actually become supportive of Russia. So even when they can see the effects of a right-wing nationalist, you know, aggressive regime trying to conquer another country, they say, oh, yeah, that's, you know, we need a strong leader like that in our country. And that's genuinely perplexing. I don't really understand how that view could have become so widespread in the United States.
Another point in your book is that people have confused liberalism as such with a certain very narrow definition of,
yes,
of liberalism,
definitely,
that became predominant in the 90s. And I think Bill Clinton and Larry Summers were very, very influential here in defining this neoliberalism as liberalism as such. And people who are Bernie Sanders socialists, they actually don't understand that what he's suggesting is just another position within liberalism. What is the heritage of neoliberalism looking back now 30 years later?
Well, okay, so there's two variants of liberalism that the enemies of liberalism have attacked. So one is what you call neoliberalism. So this was a right-wing interpretation of economic liberalism that was very anti-statist, anti-regulation, pro-privatization, you know, and so forth. That interpretation, I think, has largely burned itself out. I think that, you know, and it was a very powerful movement because not only did it get support from, you know, private property owners, businesses, corporations, and so forth, but the whole Chicago School of Economics was built around, you know, belief that private markets could govern themselves, that they could regulate themselves, and the state could withdraw from participation in a market economy, you know, pretty largely. That view, I think, has really disappeared. And there are very few economists that would try to defend that. And the policy has shifted very dramatically. So President Biden has actually kept a lot of Trump's tariffs. He's engaged in massive industrial policy, which, you know, to a neoliberal was absolute anathema. The Economist is still unhappy with, you know, with that shift. But it does indicate that that neoliberal period has really come to an end. But the other, I think, more lasting interpretation of liberalism is what you might call woke liberalism, which is the developed on the left, where liberalism, which asserts the universal equality and dignity of all people, is being replaced by a kind of identity politics in which its particular groups defined by race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, that are the real objects of, you know, the drive for social justice. And I think that, you know, at the extreme fringes, it results in this kind of very annoying political correctness. And if you listen to what Trump, Putin, Viktor Orban, you know, all of these populist nationalists are saying, they say that's liberalism. That's the essence of liberalism. You know, transgender rights is the foundation of woke liberalism, and the EU and the United States are trying to impose, you know, this version of social liberalism on everybody else. And, you know, that has a lot of resonance with people because, you know, quite frankly, a lot of this identity politics is in my view, misguided, built on, you know, wrong assumptions, and ultimately discredits, you know, the brand of liberalism.
But if you look at someone like Biden, it's not clear to me that he's very influenced by woke. I can see that it's very influential in campuses and in intellectual life and in part of the cultural life. But if I look at the Biden presidency, I think he's, you know, he's revived antitrust, what Lina Khan is doing in FTC is really trying to reinvent more FDR style liberalism. So I think he's trying to address some of the shortcomings of the first neoliberalism that you mentioned. And if you told me before the Biden presidency that this was what he would be doing, huge investment, making the green transition, a reindustrialization, reinventing antitrust policies, I'll think, well, he would be revitalizing liberalism in America. He would be making a new social contract with the workers. But it seems that, and you know, I think he's been impressive under very, very difficult parliamentary circumstances, but it seems that he's utterly failed when it comes to convincing the public.
Yeah, I think that's true. And the reason for that is that he's not taken as strong a stand against woke liberalism as he has against neoliberalism. He's not a super great supporter of woke liberalism, but he's also never broken with it. You know, Bill Clinton had this, what they call this sister soldier moment, you might remember, where he criticized this black woman, you know, for taking basically an identity politics. I forget what exactly it was, but it was a very calculated move to say, I do not support this version of social liberalism. And Biden, you know, I think had many opportunities to do that, but he hasn't really taken that. So when conservatives look at him, they see this guy that they claim is fully into the whole transgender agenda. I mean, you know, we had a recent example of that there's like a transgender day of recognition or something, and it happened to fall on Easter or close to, or I guess it was on maybe on Good Friday. And a lot of conservatives took this as a sign that Biden was deliberately demeaning Christianity by celebrating transgenderism, you know, on Holy Week, you know, this sort of thing. So he's not managed to really distance himself from that version of liberalism. And I think that that's one of the reasons why people don't regard him as a Bill Clinton type centrist.
I think if you look at liberalism in Europe, I think the question of immigration, in my view, is absolutely central to the lack of confidence liberal That's principles right. here, because it seems to be that if you want to support human rights within the European Union, you must accept that Erdogan and Libya, they are our gatekeepers. You must accept that you have brutal treatment of refugees. Morally, I'm absolutely against it, but politically, it's very, very hard to solve the problem. Because if we did not have these very, very brutal mechanisms, you'd probably have very strong right-wing parties in Europe that would undermine the human rights within the Union. How do you see this?
No, absolutely. I should have mentioned that I think immigration is one of the biggest weaknesses of Biden. And the problem is that it's really in the White House that there still is a strong pro-refugee faction within the Democratic Party that's also represented among Biden's advisors. And so, for example, I think that he would have benefited greatly if he had sponsored a really tough crackdown. You know, I mean, I'm sure you're following this, but the problem is that a lot of migrants to the United States have figured out that if they say that they are seeking asylum, you know, as refugees, they can get around a lot of the restrictions against simple, you know, immigration. And as a result, the numbers have just exploded. And it's not, you know, I think everybody agrees it's not sustainable. It's a terrible political liability for Biden. And I think that it's a big mistake that he's made not to, you know, take a stand on this. You know, he could easily say something like, we believe that immigration is good. Legal immigration builds the country. We need it for our economic security, so on and so forth. But we have to be in control of it. And we need to, you know, be able to control our southern border and determine who, you know, gets to come in and who doesn't. And he just hasn't taken that initiative.
One thing about liberalism that I've been thinking a lot about, and I'm making a little jump here, is because looking back at the last 30 years, I think it's fair to say that one of the characteristics for young people is the failure to find an adequate systemic response to climate change. And if you look at the political ideas that I grew up with, whether it was some kind of socialism, whether it was liberalism, whether it was democracy, they all assumed that nature was not a problem, that nature was a resource and a material for human development and human flourishing. It was all about regulating power, freedom, accountability among humans. And for my generation and the generation before that, what was interesting to make intellectual exercises and write papers about was all about these old political ideas. So it would, you'd have to kind of retrain yourself to think of our relation to nature and should we have rights for nature? What are our obligations? How important do you think that deficit of nature in our modern political ideas have been for the last 30 years?
Well, I think that there are different ways of thinking about this. You know, personally, I would not attack the inaction on climate in terms of the rights of nature. I think philosophically, it really doesn't make any sense. I think that you can simply criticize existing policies on the basis of human well-being, you know, that it's threatening the ability of humans to flourish, to pursue their freedoms and so forth. And I think that you can blame liberalism in the sense that, you know, what liberalism does is it creates a rule of law and it creates restrictions on government action, government power, which is something we want very much in the case of, you know, tyrants like Putin or potential tyrants like Trump. But when the government actually has to act to build wind farms and storage and transmission lines and, you know, move cities in order to get them out of, you know, low-lying coastal areas, you also have a rule of law that says, no, you can't do that. You have to get permits. You know, you have to comply with these rules and laws. And in the United States, especially here in California, we got a whole set of environmental laws that were enacted, you know, 50 years ago that are actually preventing us from adapting to climate change because they basically make it impossible to build anything. You know, you have to get a zillion permits and you have to hold 50 town meetings and, you know, so forth. And at the end of it, you still can't build, you know, your transmission lines. And so I think in that respect, you know, we have a real deficit of the ability of liberal states to act decisively, you know, in a crisis. And the climate crisis is one of the worst in political terms because it's a extremely serious one. It could be existential, but it creeps up on you so slowly that it's really hard to say, okay, now we really have to act. You know, gets a little warmer every year, and that people can still adjust to that and say, oh, it's not a real crisis that would force us to spend lots of money or take these big decisions. And I think that's really the problem. And it's true, you know, in a certain way, if you had a more authoritarian system that had the right intentions, you probably could take stronger measures to, you know, deal with climate change. Trouble is, I mean, being authoritarian in itself does not incline you to take this issue more seriously than, you know, other kinds of government. It's true in a lot of other, you know, if in El Salvador, that country has been beset by gang violence. So the gangs in El Salvador take more money in the form of extortion payments from businesses in El Salvador than the government takes in tax revenue. Gives you a kind of sense of the problem. And, you know, you've got this president, Bukele, who has basically thrown the rule of law out the window. He's arrested like 10% of, you know, the population of El Salvador. In El Salvador, it's easy to know who's a gang member because you've got all these tattoos, and he's just put them in jail. No trial, you know, no presumption of innocence. And the crime rate has dropped like 90%. And so people love him because he's not obeying the rule of law. You know, he's actually getting an outcome that people want, which is security, but he's not constrained by all of these liberal rule of law, you know, due process protections. And I think that I think liberals haven't worried about this enough because, you know, in many respect, it is their adherence to law and procedure that is preventing a lot of liberal states, liberal democracies from acting decisively in security and climate, you know, infrastructure. A lot of things are not happening because of these kinds of restrictions on government's ability to do things that are in the common good. And I think that's kind of the crisis we're in right now.
This is very tough here in Europe as well, because you see environmental groups who have based their movement on these rights to protest every new building or every new power plant and every new wind farm. That's how they've been organizing for decades. Yeah. And now they're actually standing in the way of making, making the green transition. I want to ask you about Ukraine as well, because I know you've been working with Ukraine since, I think, 2013. You've been writing about it for more than a decade. And of course, now there's the enthusiasm here in Europe and here in Denmark as well about the package that Mike Johnson got put on the floor in Congress. But still, it seems to me that the premises for the Western engagement in this war has from the beginning been that we want to make sure that Ukraine remains a sovereign state. We cannot let Putin get away with it. But we also do not want to give them weapons that could make it possible for them to attack Russia. And we don't want Western troops on the ground. And it seems to me at the moment that the Russian capacity to fight is at least not diminished. The political will is intact. All the destruction is in Ukraine. And there's the consensus that you can't make a peace deal with Putin. So I have the feeling that we can celebrate our will to do more, but the premises under which we're leading this battle by proxy seems a little bit hopeless to me.
I agree. So I think the most foolish policy on the Western side is this telling the Ukrainians not to attack targets in Russia itself. You know, right now the Russians can freely shoot missiles at any city in Kyiv. It's a losing proposition to defend yourself because Patriot missiles are really expensive. And, you know, they cost 10 times as much as the Russian missile that they shoot down. And you can't sustain a military posture like that. I think the only thing that will make the Russians more pliable is, first, on the ground, you've got to recapture, or you've got to hold the line at least, and then, you know, hopefully retake parts of Crimea or make Crimea uninhabitable for the Russians. But I think you also need deterrence by going after targets in Russia and showing the Russians themselves that they're vulnerable to the kinds of attacks that they've been visiting on the Ukrainians. And I absolutely fail to see why the Biden administration doesn't understand that logic. I think they're too worried about nuclear escalation, which I do not think is going to be triggered by this kind of attack. And, you know, in terms of not putting NATO troops on the ground, that I can see conditions under which we would move to that. If the Ukrainian regime really looked like it was collapsing, then I think, you know, we ought to really seriously consider that. But at the moment, politically, I think that would be very difficult to achieve consensus on. But certainly the idea that the Ukrainians should be able to, first of all, have the weapons that can do these long distance strikes against Russian targets, and that they should go after facilities in Russia, I think we ought to let them do that.
That also means challenging the basic premises for our support for them that's been in place for a couple of years.
I'm not sure it has. I mean, you know, for a long time we were saying don't attack targets in Crimea, even though that's sovereign Ukrainian territory, and Ukrainians didn't listen and they attacked targets. Nothing happened, no escalation. So, I you know, it seems to me that this is a restriction that we've been trying to impose for a long time, and it makes no sense.
I want to ask you one last question about Israel as well, because I'm curious how you see this situation at the moment. Because on the one hand, you have a lot of non-Western countries who put a lot of faith into the liberal institutions. And it seems you could say this is the triumph of the liberal order, that you have states like South Africa going to ICJ, you have the non-permanent members of the Security Council, and they bring up a proposal that ends up being voted through. So they, they're not very liberal states. So you could say, well, they're hypocrites. Look at how they're treating their own. Look at what South Africa did with Bashir. So we can point to hypocrisy, but as Hegelians, we know that hypocrisy is driving the world forward. On the other hand, you could also say that this is the moment where the West is losing the global public opinion.
Yes.
Because America is complaining about the consequences of the war, and they're complaining about the famine and the starvation, the disasters, the killing of journalists and humanitarian aid workers. And yet this week as well, they will vote a package through that sends more weapons to Israel. And this seems to nourish the geopolitical nihilism of Russia and China, saying, well, they don't mean anything. So this seems to be such an open moment to me. How do you see it?
You know, early in my career, I was quite heavily involved in the Arab-Israeli conflict in the aftermath of Camp David when I was in the State Department. And, you know, I don't focus on this conflict as much right now. And the reason is that, unlike Ukraine versus Russia, the moral evaluation of this conflict is very complicated, because both sides have done terrible things. Both sides, you know, need to be held accountable for all sorts of terrible policies that they've fostered. And for that reason, you know, it's hard to become a really hard partisan of either one. And so therefore, I've kind of tried to stay away from that. However, I do think that as a matter of both foreign policy and domestic politics, Biden probably should have supported a ceasefire, you know, much earlier, and used the leverage that the United States has in terms of weapons supply in order to get Netanyahu to back down. Because I don't think that you can eradicate Hamas. I think that, you know, you need to start thinking really hard about a governance outcome in Gaza that will actually allow the people there to survive, you know, this horrible conflict. So yes, I think that Biden has leaned a little bit too hard in support of Israel.
Just one last question connected to that, because it seems to be a generational moment, the response to the Israel war.
in America, it seems that there's a young generation that grew up with Netanyahu and settlers and who don't have the memory that my parents had, that Holocaust was the ultimate disaster, Israel was a miracle, and they feel like an obligation to support the Jewish state almost no matter what they do. Whereas the young people, they don't grow up with Holocaust as the ultimate horizons, but they grew up with racism and colonialism as the ultimate horizon. And this is, and you know, you can look in Germany where you see it's really, really damaging for the, for the public debate. And it seems to me that the cancel culture here has moved actually from the left to those supporting Israel. How do you see that?
No, that's right. I've been very surprised at how big a mobilization you've had on university campuses in favor of the Palestinians. I mean, it's hard not to be sympathetic with the Palestinians, but it depends which Palestinians. And a lot of, you know, these young people are all in favor of Hamas, which I think is a, you know, murderous terrorist organization. Now, some of that is just ignorance, you know, that they haven't followed the conflict, you know, all that closely. You know, that generational shift, I think, is important. This is also an area where identity politics has become very important, because you have this whole narrative about settler colonialism, you know, that's the framework in which many young people see Israel, that the whole enterprise, the whole nation is illegitimate, you know, right from the beginning. And that's something that's developed intellectually over the last generation that didn't exist for, you know, people in an older generation.
As someone working in the university, have you been surprised by the political pressure on the leadership of the universities?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, in the United States, the political pressure comes in a lot of directions. So you have the students that are very angry and upset, but you've got donors, you know, since American universities rely much more heavily than European ones on private donors, and many of them are, they're older, they're more conservative, a lot of them are Jewish, and it's just set up this terrible conflict between the people that are actually supporting higher education and the people that are benefiting from it.
Well, thank you so much for taking your time. It's been a privilege to talk to you again.
Okay. Thanks very much for talking to me.
And have a good day in California.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Det var så min samtale med Francis Fukuyama. Den var sat sammen, redigeret, klippet, produceret af vores fuldstændig vidunderlige hjælper og kammerat Albert Kuhlmann. Tak fordi I lyttede med. Jeg håber, I også vil være lyttet med i næste uge.